This sound recording is prepared by the Audiovisual Center of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri. No copy of this tape is to be made without written permission of the Audiovisual Center. On November 2, 1967, Dr. Eugene L. Smith, American Executive Secretary of the World Council of Churches, speaks on the nature and function of the World Council of Churches. His topic is Unity, Justice, and Evangelism.
Few little figures on the board, ladies and gentlemen, are just to give you an idea in a sort of a concise summary that the 20th century is really a conciliar century. The various branches of the ecumenical movement prior to the founding of the World Council of Churches were the International Missionary Council of Faith and Order Movement and the Life and Work Movement, and the World Council of Churches came into existence in 1948 and, as you see, has a number of assemblies to its record and will meet again next year in Sweden. The Lutheran churches of the world, which are very affiliated with a council, began to meet in 23 and went under the title of Lutheran World Convention for a number of meetings, and then became the Lutheran World Federation with a meeting scheduled for Latin America in a few years. And then, of course, the third great council, in addition to the World Council and the Lutheran World Federation, is the Vatican Council. And that has had four world assemblies with no immediate prospects of a resumption of such work. Now, we have with us tonight a gentleman, Dr. Eugene L. Smith, who for 12 years was a pastor in the Methodist Church and then served the Board of Missions of the Methodist Church in this country, and now for the last few years has been on the staff of the World Council of Churches that has its headquarters in Geneva, but his task is to serve as a liaison between the Council and the 30 member communions in the United States of America. Although I listed the National Council of Churches of Christ in the USA, that council is not the group that he works for, nor to whom he represents the World Council, but rather to the 30 member denominations in this country. Dr. Smith speaks to us on a very exciting subject, unity, justice, and evangelism, and I think he will demonstrate to us that the fear that many people sometimes express about organized ecumenism, that it is anything but theological, those fears will be dispelled after we have heard him. Dr. Smith, will you address us, please, on unity, justice, and evangelism?
Thank you for a helpful introduction. Forgive me if I express a bit of amusement about the meetings. May I tell you a story about the real beginnings of the international aspect of the ecumenical movement? A teacher was teaching a class in history. She tried to make it real to the kids, and so she had each child say during what epoch in history the child would like to have lived. And most of the boys would like to have lived during the Wild West. But prim little Mary said she wanted to live during the Crusades. Mary, why would you want to live during the Crusades? Mary said, well, I love God and I like to travel. We right now have such an enormous problem with all the Americans who love God and want to go to the Fourth Assembly of the World Council of Churches in Geneva, at Uppsala next summer. So many that the meeting would be ruined by an overload of Americans at that point. Right now, for me, it has a good deal of urgency. I'm honored to be here. And grateful and a bit frightened by trying to talk to you on this question of unity, justice, and evangelism. Because I think that it maybe the leverage issue in the relationship between Christians, in the deeper sense in the relationship between the World Council and any group or other groups, but between all Christians. Best way I know to describe it is to deal with the question of the nature of the church, the nature of the church's task in the world today. And I take it that we agree this is an important question, the nature of the church's task in the world. Christ came not to save the church, but to save the world. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him might be saved. God is in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. I don't need to quote more. These are not proof texts. This is a granitic core of gospel truth. What is the task of the church in the world today? Because I think it's only in light of that task that we can see the relationship between unity and justice and evangelism. And obviously, the first part of the task is to make Christ known. The need of human beings to know the grace of God in Jesus Christ is a deeper, more driving, and if unsatisfied, more dangerous need than any other need which human beings have. Christ is a person. I have been in many discussions on the theology of missions. I have been in them in Pentecostal circles. I have been in them in what accurately could be called fundamentalist circles. I've been in them in the circles of the National Council and the World Council, and I'm always surprised by the ease with which we human beings can move over into talking as though Christ were a set of concepts, a theology, a body of ideas, which we present in the Christian mission. And I have seen this kind of attitude always denied but yet implied in all such groups. This is, of course, a constant danger of human pride. He is a person who uses us in his mission. We speak to him in prayer and he responds. He speaks to us and maybe we respond. The only question that is important about any of us is whether we are open to his coming to us. Nothing else is really important. If we are open to his coming, then we will be in serious trouble, but we can handle it. If we are closed to his coming, then all else goes wrong. It is altogether likely that here it isn't necessary to stress this as much as it may be in some circles where I go. But I suspect that the Christian needs to be reminded of this almost continually. Because of the nature of our pride and our desire to be the rulers of our lives instead of his being our ruler. I think of a hospital in Mutambara in southern Rhodesia. Never had a doctor, but an extraordinary Norwegian nurse. He brought into the hospital a girl who had gone to town, had been passed from one man to another, until when she got into the hospital, she had primary, secondary, and tertiary syphilis. And tertiary syphilis, in our climate, would mean paresis, would mean the destruction of the supergranular layer of the brain, hopeless and incurable insanity. But there she also had malaria, and had it so repeatedly that the high fever had burned out the spirochete before it got to her brain. Her brain was intact. Body was covered with sores. In the process, she'd been terribly hurt. She lay in the hospital most of the time with her face to the wall, almost antagonistically resistant to the love that Ruth Hansen gives her patients. Her body responded slowly to the drug. Until finally one day she could take it no more, and if Ruth Hansen cared for her, she rolled out of the bed, she lay on the floor, she grasped Ruth Hansen's ankle, a very African gesture, then in a very un-African way, she cried out, "Why are you so good to me?" Broke out into wild sobs, and the floodgates were open. Ruth sat on the floor and gathered the girl in her arms. And this crowded ward became very still. When Ruth, as the sobbing ceased, praying to know what to say, said, "I am not the one who is good to you. It is Christ. He came to me when I was a little girl in Norway and told me someday to come to Africa. And he is here now. And he comes to heal us of our diseases and to cleanse us of our sins. And he comes to you now, if you will accept him." Now that girl walked out of that hospital a transformed woman. a good secular movement like the Peace Corps, and I've been a director of the Peace Corps agency, I'm proud of it. It can pump her full of penicillin and send her back to be what she was. But she walked out a different one. She went back to the last man she lived with and brought him to Christ. And their home now is a center of hope, not just for the village, but for the whole valley. This is a central task of the church. Not only to bring her to Christ, but to surround her with a healing fellowship of worshiping congregation of forgiven and forgiving people, in which the fellowship that our Lord Jesus Christ makes is an experienced reality. The need for this cannot be overstated. The task of the church is an evangelistic task. But in the United States, we need to take a hard look at the difference between evangelism and apostasy. And I use a hard word, but I think that the issue is important enough to justify a difficult one. And let me use an illustration. I speak of a church in a southern city. I, as a Yankee, regret using an illustration from the South. It's perfectly clear now that the racial situation is even more difficult in some ways in the North than in the South. But this illustration happens to be so clear. This is a wealthy, prestige church, which has decided that no Negroes should worship in the sanctuary. On a Sunday morning, a group of Negro students from a nearby college were trying to enter the sanctuary. The nature of their motives is something that only they and God could answer to. But the ushers, well-trained, above all, you must be genteel, stood at the shoulder to shoulder at the top of the impressive steps that come up, stone steps. They stood shoulder to shoulder like this. And as they came up, as the students came up, they pushed them like this with their elbows. As this went on, a girl was caught on the shoulder, fell back down the stairs, was hurt, a bad head wound. And while this happened, the congregation inside was singing, "Love Divine, All Is Excellent." Now that church has every year big revival service. It brings, at large fees, the best known evangelist in the United States. And every year, the people of that congregation are called to come forward and reconsecrate themselves to Christ. And many do. What really happens in this process? What really happens when there is an issue at the top of your mind, because in that town, go into any group, anytime, anywhere, and the conversation will turn to the racial issue sometime. This is an issue at the top of the thinking. What really happens when there can be an issue like this, which has profound ethical implications, and you can year after year after year reconsecrate yourself to Christ in an act of worship and receive the blessing of the pastor, the evangelist, and go out without ever any change in your thinking, without even your question, your thinking at that point being brought under the shadow of the cross? What happened? I used to teach clinical psychology at New York University, and it's perfectly clear what happened. Each time you go through this religious form, without the major ethical issue in your life being brought under the judgment of Christ, what you actually do is erect another invisible barrier between Christ and that issue. A religious ceremony is used to insulate part of your life from the Lordship of Christ. And I have to say that this is not revival. This is not evangelism in the Christian sense. This is apostasy. This is using the name of Christ, in effect, to deny the Lordship of Christ, to make it easier to continue to say, "I am a Christian," without bringing this part of my life under the judgment of Christ. The basic task of the church is an evangelistic task. It is a task that requires, among other things, an honest look at the world in which we live. Let me try an honest look at the world in which we live. If we had a map, I would ask you to look with me at the line, which is today the anvil on which history is being hammered out. It's not a line dividing east-west anymore, it's a line dividing north-south. It follows the 30th parallel in the northern hemisphere, except that in Asia, it follows the Russian boundary. Interestingly enough, if you're curious about the relationship between culture and climate, the same contrasts that I'll describe in a minute obtain in the southern hemisphere along the 30th parallel, but the land mass is in the temperate tropics in the northern zone, and here is where history is being. Do you see the line which divides the United States from Latin America, goes just north of Cuba, which divides Africa, which divides Europe from Africa, and divides Russia from the rest of Asia? North of this line, a population largely white, with a very mixed record in race relations. South of this line, a much larger population, overwhelmingly colored, with bitter memories of white arrogance and race relations. The only major segment south of the line which is white is Latin America, with even more bitter memories of Yankee imperialism. North of this line, the historic strongholds of the Christian faith. South of this line, the historic strongholds of the non-Christian faith. North of this line, the expanding economies. South of the line, the exploding population. North of the line, the unprecedented concentrations of prosperity. And south of the line, the unprecedented concentrations of poverty. With certain historic factors working in almost a demonic fashion to increase continually the contrast north and south of this line. The first time this was described as a factor that I know in the world was by an officer of the World Bank at a meeting of the World Council of Churches of Geneva at in Denmark in 1957. But this line really became visible to everybody at the World Conference on Trade and Aid called by the United Nations in Geneva in 1964. For on the questions of trade and aid, as the voting began, each nation voted individually. This was so futile that soon they turned to continental groupings, and this was not decisive. In the last 3 days, when the real issues were up for action, the voting was in a straight north-south line. The 27 developed nations in the north, the 77 developing nations in the great middle belt, and Russia and the United States voted together on every single issue because their economic interest is the same. The 27 nations of the north, industrialized nations, using trade, which we control to such an amazing degree, that the one crop economies, one or two crop economies of these agrarian nations shall be used where we can get raw material, process it, and sell it back at a profit. And the economists of the great middle belt see no difference in the foreign policy, the trade policies of Russia and the United States. Now, why is this an issue that you talk about in the church? By 1970, we probably will be at the point of a new kind of famine. Up to this point in history, famines have been local and sporadic, related to immediate circumstances and a specific situation. The change of those circumstances and the famines have tended to disappear. By 1970 at least, and it's already been true to some degree in northeast Brazil, we will have a new kind of famine, the regional and chronic famine. India, Turkey, Pakistan, Iran, perhaps China, nobody really knows. Perhaps more in northeast corner of Brazil. These are the first places. And the question of famine and a new dimension in the world becomes at last to some degree for us in the United States a question of conscience. What are the factors that make this contrast between the north and the south so increasingly explosive? The 27 northern nations are becoming more prosperous every year, with the demographic pattern, becoming comparatively older. The median age in the United States now is 27 years. And in many ways becoming more conservative. While the great middle belt, where the majority of mankind lives, are becoming more hungry, more radical, and more youthful. The median age in all Latin America now is 19. In Africa, it's probably 70. It's estimated in Asia to be 18. And with the population explosion, that figure is going down as it's going up with us. So we become older, more conservative, more affluent. Well, the great majority of mankind in the places threatened by famine become younger, more radical, more hungry. What are the factors contributing to this? One is our control of trade. The Kennedy Round of 27 prosperous nations negotiating with each other for mutual benefit. And to the real damage of the economic interests of the 77 nations that were left out. To be more specific, in 1956 in Brazil, it cost a Brazilian 30 bags of Brazilian coffee to buy a Ford car. Today, it costs him 220 bags of coffee. The same kind of thing has happened to the price of cocoa in West Africa, to tin in Bolivia, to the nitrates in Chile. Another factor is a brain drain. The London School of Economics estimated last February that in the United States now there are 100,000 professionals, technicians, scientists, who came from the 77 developing nations, whose basic education was given them there, who received their advanced education in the United States and now are pouring their resources, their energy into the incredible dynamism of this country, but whose basic education given them by the countries from which they came, which countries need their skills so greatly, cost those countries in dollars more than the amount of foreign aid given by the United States since the end of World War II. In the same way, Britain is bleeding the Commonwealth of its brain. And nations which need these technical skills if they're to develop competitive economies are robbed of them. Another factor is our erosion of commitment to foreign aid. In 1948-49, when Europe, which was white, was in trouble, we gave 2% of our gross national product to get Europe on its feet. This year, when five times as many people, not 300 million, but 1,500,000,000, face far greater tragedy, our giving, figured on the same basis, is not 2% of our gross national product, but 0.3 of 1% of our gross national product. And most of this is in loans. I want to stay with the question of foreign aid just a bit, because this is a moral issue. It is not a technical issue. It isn't even the question of the very difficult question of balance of payments. It isn't a financial issue. This nation decided to put a man on the moon. Okay, we put a man on the moon. This won't even dent our national economy seriously. The byproducts will enrich education and science at many points. We had to mobilize incredible number of brains. We had to put in billions of dollars. We can do this. It would take just a fraction of the mobilization of that much brains really to develop an effective foreign aid program in Latin America, but we don't have it. We have good foreign aid people. We have foreign aid people who are the envy of Germany and of France and of Italy and of Israel and of Japan and England that want to develop effective programs. But we haven't mobilized the brains. You know how much money it would take? The World Bank says that the 77 developing nations in capital, which they could constructively use a year for capital investment, need about $8 billion a year more than they're now getting. How much is this? Everyone in the last 3 years, our increase in gross national product has been, it was 44 million, 44 billion, 40 billion, 43 billion last year, and it will be more than, at present rate, it will be more than 43 billion this year.
$8 billion, if it had to come all from the United States, would be just 1/5 of our annual increase in our GNP. Just 1/5 of our annual increase. But as we become more wealthy, the resistance to foreign aid becomes more intense. When the last food bill was presented to Congress, Senator McGovern asked Joe Gumillion and me to go down there. Joe Gumillion is the Roman Catholic Monsignor, who is now Secretary of the Papal Commission on Secretariat on Development, Justice, and Peace. And we met with McGovern and with 8 senators and 4 congressmen. It was a private hearing, and they wanted to talk to us, and they asked a question, and you might like to sit in front of a bunch of senators and congressmen and answer this. Why are the Christians in the United States so resistant to foreign aid? You have to talk about this in the church, because finally it's a question of whether we care. If we care enough, we'll mobilize a brain. We can lick every technical problem there is. We know enough. You can get more facts about Brazil in some American universities than you can get in Brazil. There are today more Americans with PhDs doing sociological study in Brazil than the total number of Brazilians who have PhDs in sociology. There are more facts about Brazil in some of our American universities than there are in Brazil. You won't learn about Brazil all these facts. We know enough. It's whether we care enough. And in a nation where more than 60% of the population are voluntarily registered as members of worshiping congregations, where more people are in church on Sunday morning than any other major nation, if ever there was a place where the question of the church about people caring is real, it's with us. Trouble is, the statistics don't bleed. You and I can hear that 12,000 people will die of starvation between now and tomorrow night at this time. You know, so what? 12,000 people die of starvation. It won't keep you awake tonight. If I ran over a dog with a car, it would upset me viscerally more deeply to hear him yell than it would to be told that 12,000 people can die of starvation between now and the time that I eat 3 more meals. Are we able to hear the voices of our brothers and our sisters as they cry? This is a profoundly Christian cry. I have never seen as many signs that this nation is dead center on the moral issue, stuck dead center, as I think we have seen since September. I don't say what I now say because I like to. I live outside the United States so much, and I defend it so much from unjust attacks, that I've had reason to discover how much I love this country. And sometimes I'm surprised. I make no complaint about the incredible privilege of paying income tax in this country. But the signs that we are stuck dead center morally, terrible. The city riots. They were predicted as conservative a journal as the Wall Street Journal.
Judge, world, sure.
2 years ago said 21 cities are dead ripe for riots. We knew. Did we do anything? No. Detroit was predicted. Newark was predicted. Did we do anything? No. Have we done anything in the other cities that haven't yet exploded? Real? No. One of the most chilling things that's going on in the United States right today is a spread in so many states of punitive legislation about welfare. The increasing number of state legislatures that are saying that in the matter of welfare in this state, there can be, for instance, an arbitrary number of illegitimate children who can get food from welfare. And you get above that figure by one, and that kid can starve to death. And the legislatures of this kind of legislation is now appearing and being passed in more than 30 states. The legislation that says that a woman with children without a husband can get food for the kids only if she works so many hours a day. That is, she can only feed the kids if she abandons them, because she hasn't got money enough to babysit them. What really can only accurately be described as a middle-class hostility toward poor people. And this kind of legislation is right now in Washington, and there's no protest. Where are the real values of the American people? The school pressures for achievement. You know, I suppose, the statistics of the rise in suicide rates in high school. The number of hours the kids have to take homework at night and homework every weekend. Still, a national educator said not very long ago that not since the earliest days of the Industrial Revolution have kids had to work so hard and so long. And the schools where this is worse are in the suburbs of the young executives, where the family is fighting so hard to make its way up the competitive ladder that they'll tolerate anything from the kids except academic failure. Where are the real standards of the American people? After the unbearable stink of Baker and Adam Clayton Powell and Senator Dodds and the unmistakable need for a code of legislative ethics, there isn't a sign of such a code. And there isn't much sign that the people of America are demanding it out of Washington. We can assassinate a president, we can have all these city riots, but we can't get through legislation on firearms control. Who runs Congress? And if you watch Congress, you watch Washington. It's quite clear that the priority is much higher on highway transportation and supersonic transport than it is on poverty. Where are the values of the American people? I am afraid. I have never felt this way. Because this sign of moral impasse comes at a time when we occupy a pinnacle of power in the world that the world has never seen before. I don't know how much time to take on this. I could illustrate it quite a bit. Our economic power. There is a new word in international finance, it's Canadianization. Canadianization describes a nation whose economy is run by the United States the way Canada's economy is run by us. Brazil, Argentina, how many more? I could talk quite a bit more about this. By and large, Australia just had a governmental study, did this and then they didn't dare produce the results because American management is so much more enlightened than the management of the other countries that the employee policies, the labor policies, all this are much better off because of the influence of American finance. This isn't the issue, but the incredible power that we have. The number of nations where the U.S. Embassy has such enormous influence on internal affairs in the life of that nation. No nation ever occupied the pinnacle of power that we occupy today. At a moment of supreme confusion about how we're going to use it, of which Vietnam is just one symbol. What does this say to the church? What does this say as to the nature of evangelism? What does it really mean in this nation to call a person to accept Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior and live at the foot of the cross of Jesus Christ? There are enormous reservoirs of idealism in this country. You know the change in the mood of the law schools in the last 10 years? 10 years ago, the top boys out of the law school went to Wall Street. Now the top 10% of the law schools are going into the war on poverty. They're really seeking to serve the poor. There's a tremendous reservoir, and it isn't being tapped. And it isn't being tapped in a nation where the church is stronger than any nation in the world. Somehow we have to see this in terms of people. At 3:00 a.m. in Calcutta. A girl asleep on the sidewalk. From her caste markings, from her dress, it was obvious that she was not a Bengali. She didn't know the language of the city. One baby, asleep, mouth still at a breast that was strangely dried and withered for a teenage girl. Another baby, asleep between her knees. Another asleep on his shoulder. A refugee from famine. And when the merciless heat of the sun and the crowd makes it impossible to sleep in the street anymore, then another day begins, which is a sequence of hours of drugged fatigue while she rummages in garbage, seeking food to extend life a little longer. Now, the day has long since come and gone when the garbage man, because that was Calcutta, when the garbage man picked up her body and threw it into one of their carts. And that morning, it was the garbage man who decided whether the babies were still alive and stayed on the sidewalk or dead and went in the cart. The scripture said to us that pure religion and undefiled is to care for widows and orphans in their trouble and keep oneself free from the stain of the world. What does it mean to care for that woman and her children in trouble? Just to pick her up and feed her kids? Then what about the girl who takes her place? In a world today where probably 500 million people don't have enough food, where probably half of the children of the world today are being deformed in body and mind because they don't have enough food, can you say you care for that widow and her children if you just take care of her? Seems to me that caring for that woman means not only going to her with the word of Christ in full power, but it means the church becoming involved sacrificially and dangerous in terms of all the basic decisions of human beings about the factors that create family. What else does it mean for the church to live under the lordship of Christ? Let me just try one illustration and see if I'm honest about this. A dock strike in Marseille. And as you know, relations between labor and management in France are far more difficult than in the United States. The gap is enormously wider. A bitter strike. Real starvation among the families of the strikers. And a request coming to a little congregation run by the McCall Mission for the pastor, Pastor Velton of the Reformed Church, that they feed the families, that they set up soup kitchens and feed the families of the strikers. Velton talked to me about it. He said the first miracle was that this request didn't split the congregation down the middle because the congregation included both management and labor. With strange wisdom. Before the congregation discussed the question, he led them in a study of the story of the feeding of the 5,000 by our Lord. The first miracle, he says, was that it didn't split the congregation irrevocably. The second miracle was that after this piece of Bible study, they decided they would set up a soup kitchen. And the third miracle was that they fed the families of 5,000 people. 70,000 meals for an average cost of 5 cents each. Food came from amazing sources. They were given a warehouse to make into a soup kitchen. One day he and 30 of the strikers were unloading sacks of potatoes. A fellow slipped on the greasy floor, fell under a sack of potatoes, was hurt, and the strikers agreed profanely that they're going to have to clean up the floor, and their plan was to break into the struck dockyard and get steel wire brushes. Well, as Belton walked back and forth, sweating under his sack of potatoes, he wondered, how do you talk to them about the ethics of stealing? I'm a Christian pastor, what do you do? And finally, he remembered that they were communists, and at least communists have the advantage of an eschatology. They believe that a classless society is coming. And so he said to them, you guys think there's going to be a classless society, don't you? Yeah, they all did. That's really why they were communists. He says, in that classless society, are there going to be strikes? No. Going to be hunger? No. Going to be stealing? No. Well, he said, I believe a classless society is coming too. Don't think it'll come the way you think it is. It's going to be established by Christ. But it is Christ who sent us here. He told me he expected them to laugh. But I mean, after all, the kids are getting fed. And they didn't. He says, I believe that in this classless society, there won't be any stealing. And I don't think you get ready for it by denying it. Maybe this is the next miracle. They scraped together enough money to buy one steel brush. They cleaned the floor. There's an artist in Marseille who was so impressed by what they did that he came and asked them for a gift, and they had a rather bare church, and they wanted a cross in a space on the wall. And when they decided the size of the cross, it was the size that would hang on a man. And the artist made it in his home. And then to deliver it, he had to carry the cross on his shoulder. This prominent communist through the busy streets of Marseille. He's a Christian now. More than half of those strikers are Christian. Because a church articulated the name of Christ at the point of human suffering, the struggle for justice in the structure of society. It is to this kind of evangelism, which is sacrificially and painfully involved in the struggle for justice, that I think we're called. And I think it's at last only on the basis of this kind of evangelism that we can find any Christian unity that's faithful to the gospel.
Smith is kind enough to have consented to field questions for a short period of time. I forgot to tell you when I introduced him that I think I told you he was a member of the Methodist Church, but he has had a varying career of having been a minister in a parish situation for about a dozen years, and then he worked in missions for 15 years for the Methodist Church. His seminary is Drew. That's the one in Madison, New Jersey, but he has a doctorate in psychology from New York University, and then you said you taught clinical psychology for a while as well. So he's a man of several disciplines and experience. I'll give him a good experience by throwing him some questions, if you like. That's up to you, if you have any. Dr. G.
Well, Dr. Smith, you brought into my mind that you brought up many area of problems and questions related to not only the United States, but a global scale of problems. I think among this, perhaps the most crucial area to my mind is the brain drain of problem of this, and brain drain about which you just suggest. My question is, this is really global. It's not the hunger problem, I mean, to me, it's a very small problem in comparison with this kind of problem, because this problem is really affecting upon not only Asia, but also other countries, as you mentioned now. My question is, except a few small type of course, you know, encouraging them to go back, you know, or appealing to their patriotism or something like that. Well, these are some of the methods how we can persuade these brains, which are needed in their countries, to go back and work. But those methods, these are not, I don't think, the basic answer, because, first of all, man cannot live by just the air or an ideology either. So that really is just a choice. I have sympathy for those people who think the other side. But my question is, have you ever thought about some more concrete solution to this global problem? And either you or, I'm talking about you, the WCC, or even the United Nations together. Now, to me, if this continues like this, for another, let's say, one or two more generations, just gradually, population increase, but then the usable skills and talents and brains actually, it just literally drains to the other places where who can afford more expensive brain and more expensive labor, you know, such as in America. In other words, you can hire any kind of combat brain with any kind of remuneration, while the other places we need it, so we cannot afford it. So actually, this is quite a dilemma. At the same time, we cannot blame those people, there are thousands and thousands of people who are remaining here and getting food for different degrees and the like, staying here. We cannot blame them either. After all, they are not obligated, and that is not more than any other people, to their own particular country. there has to be some kind of solution to this.
There's been a great deal of thinking about this. How much we should go into it, I don't know. And the brain drain is not just because of money. In very recent years, there have been 1,800 technicians who come from Argentina to the United States. I really think many of them coming simply because a technician in the United States can be in the kind of laboratory where he really can do what he's technically trained to do. In Argentina, he has to do what he's trained to do, and then a lot of the stuff that assistants would do up here. And they feel that they can simply use their skills more effectively. I am not critical of them. Yes, a lot of things are being done. One of the basic needs we need to do is put money into universities in other countries. We need to put money into laboratories in other countries. We need to stop bringing people from overseas to here below the level of graduate study. Excuse me if I say this, but the one agency in the United States that's been the most effective in this has been our Methodist Crusade Scholarship Program, and I say this in secular agencies. Because when we bring people from over here to study, we bring those that were selected in that country and are obligated to that country through money that is given to the church in that country. They don't feel obligated to us in the United States. And they are brought back to go to a job already selected to which they are to go back. And under these circumstances, we've had very high record of their going back. I'm frank to say that there are times when we went to the Immigration Bureau and said, send them. And it seemed pretty hard in the church to do this, but it was wise. There are many remedial steps being taken. Whether they are enough, I don't know.
But you mean do the graduate education more and more in the country so they don't even have to leave?
Don't leave the country until they get the best education they can get out of that country. You see, when they come here too immature, they never go back.
No.
Don't bring them out until they've got the very best education they've had in the country and until they've had a couple years of work experience. Don't tempt them to the flesh pots of this country until they're mature. Then bring them for a specific job for a specific period of time to go back to a specific job. And don't you pick them and send them and make them obligated to you. Give the church out there the resources to do it and have them feel obligated to the church out there which chose them. Keep their roots in their own country. We have to cut a lot of the American paternalism if we're going to do this. And then don't let sentimental congregations start giving them gifts.
Well, it's a vicious circle, isn't it, Dr. Smith?
No. The
Pakistanis and Indians go to England and staff their hospitals to 50%. The British doctors and technicians come to Canada, and then they leave Canada and come here, and then we send people to take care of the sick in India. It's really terrible.
There are more MDs born in Iran who are practicing medicine in the United States than the total number of practicing doctors in the nation of Iran. And what this means for human suffering in Iran is just beyond the power to describe.
Next, thank you. And by the way, that's Dr. G from Seoul, Korea. He's a professor of theology there and he's teaching here now. Dr. Ray.
About the foreign aid program, what is the answer? What is going to be done now to, is it necessary to rouse the congressmen? Is it necessary that we become more educated and active in it, or what is the answer?
Well, very quickly, and it sounds arrogant for me to think I know the answers, but I would say three things. First of all, there needs to be honest education about it. It is frightening the way, and you know, a good journalist knows what his people want to read. You get a piece of bad news about foreign aid and it'll be headline. Get a good piece of news about foreign aid and it hardly appears in the newspaper. There is a real slant on this in the United States now out of a good many factors. A second thing we need to do is one of the major mistakes we made in foreign aid is we developed a program for Europe. It worked tremendously, put Western Europe on its feet on the Marshall Plan. Then with some modifications, though, what we basically did was try to take this European pattern, superimpose it on Asia, Africa, and Latin America. This is our big mistake. And we actually need to recreate rather fundamentally a lot of our procedures. But we haven't been willing to be this flexible. Another major thing we need to do is to do this through the United Nations instead of unilaterally. The amount of money that we waste by doing it unilaterally and insisting there be a United States label on it in order to buy gratitude is first of all a tribute to our stupidity, and second, it's a terrific waste of money. You don't buy gratitude. There are the places I have been where we have developed a good agricultural program, and the Russians have put in a road 200 miles somewhere else, And so the agricultural products rot in the field, and the road is unused. This kind of thing you can multiply all over. If we were willing to swallow our pride and put the money into the United Nations where there is a multilateral pattern of giving, and then you could have a unified program of development in a country, we'd buy far more for dollars. And I think we need to realize you don't go into foreign aid to buy gratitude. You don't go in to buy friends. This is contemptuous of human beings. You go in because you care about human beings. This is why especially I think it's the job of the church to make this clear.
Has there any progress been made in Calcutta with the massive onslaught on the poverty that was undertaken about starting 1965 before Cook left there? You know, they were going to import about 2,000 experts in all branches. And they said if they could lick Calcutta, there was nothing in the world that would defy solution. Do you know anything about that?
Yes.
It's still underway, I
imagine. It's still underway. There's no breakthrough yet. The refugees are all out now of the railroad station section. Part of the problem is in Calcutta, whether you can isolate Calcutta from India. And to be honest about the problems, I just increasingly am not sure whether Hinduism has the kind of internal discipline which there has to be for development. We can go into this question a lot. But you can go, if a nation is going to go into development, then it has to produce more than it spends for quite a period of time to accumulate investment capital. This is a long story. Whether Hinduism is capable of producing this kind of internal elan, I really doubt. This is why I think the picture in India is incredibly discouraging.
Okay.
You were going to?
Sure.
This famine you talked about, do you have any particular approaches or anything that's being done to counteract this regional or chronic famines that we can see coming? Do you think through the United Nations the way to approach this, send advisors there?
Pretty hard-nosed plans involving the additional expenditure up to $8 billion a year in capital investment, quite a bit of which would be for fertilizer industry, are on the boards if they could be implemented. Pretty hard-nosed plans for aggressive birth control programs are on the boards if there are the resources and the personnel to implement them. I think you have to be altogether honest and say that in a world as complex and dynamic as this, you can't guarantee the success of any plan. I think one thing that we need in the United States much more is trained and committed personnel to go with them. In proportion to population, we have far fewer trained people in development working outside than either France or Italy, England have. As a matter of fact, in terms of sheer numbers, they have more than we do, in spite of the difference in size of our population. On a problem so many faceted, there have to be many approaches. One of the really creative things being done is by some people in southern Mexico working in the villages to develop cooperatives, where primitive people get some discipline in handling currency, which is one of the things that has to be learned. I think we could make a dent in it with the resources that were available if we were mobilized.
How about making more food available?
I think there's a very widespread feeling that this may be necessary on a short-term basis, but it's very short-term. And the complications on this are great indeed. I think the administration has recognized this in the change of the subsidized program for the farmers.
Professor Zeidler.
Well, Dr. Smith, I was touched by your presentation. It was more than a lecture, it was an indictment and proclamation. And the question that always bothers me about all this is, what can we do, little man, at the seminary, when you're faculty member or student, the tremendous complex challenge? I really would like to talk about.
You mean now, or in over a long haul?
Now and over the long haul, yeah.
I mean, this...
I mean, it bothers me, and it should bother me. but I'm absolutely frustrated when it comes to being able to take what I would call a course of action. Because the situation is so complex and in so many ways beyond my reach.
This question is too honest for a quick answer. I don't mean to evade it. I suppose now I'm speaking theologically. I believe that God is able to use every passionate piece of caring. I don't think anybody had any idea what would result from King starting this bus strike in Montgomery. He sure had no guarantee of success even of that, but that the whole civil rights movement would come out of it. I hope I don't sound flippant when I say that it seems to me we're at a moment when God is kicking us instead of leading us. I think he's trying really to kick us out of our shell holes and see if we're ready to move. And he's not ready to show us much direction until he finds out whether we're ready to move. And the first movement may be very scattered. It may be very untidy. It may be very disparate. At this point, strangely, I have hope because I see so many people caring. But let me be more specific. How often in your congregations are there periods of sustained intercession for the people of China? When you think of the suffering that it must be to live in Shanghai, to live in Peking, to live in Canton, how much passionate intercession has there been in your congregation for the people of Cuba when Cuba's been in the headlines so much? I think this is an honest, I'm trying to be honest about it. I was mad in Madrid one time a number of years ago when I saw the lack of freedom that was given to the evangelical church, and a pastor there put me under terrible rebuke, a young boy, first class. I was mad because he couldn't do this and mad because he couldn't do that. He said, look, I got more freedom than I know how to use. I can burn myself out 24 hours a day and I still need more time to do what I can do. Why do I worry about having freedom beyond this? I expect that if we seek deeply, passionately enough, God will show every one of us something additional tomorrow. And I haven't any idea what it is for anyone. But I expect that it's out of this untidy groping.